Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of BSing with Sean K. I'm your host, Sean Neese. And on this show, I have long-form interviews with people who are pursuing their creative and intellectual passions. Though it's not what you might have planned, you know it really ought to be bad. Keep your fingers out of your nose. Keep your fingers. And this is episode 99. And for this episode, I'm going to play you a conversation I had with a musician, music teacher, singer-songwriter, and children's music musician. I already said musician, but she's working on writing children's music. And yeah, her name's DZ Zimmer, and she is on my improv team on Sunday nights called Folks About the Town, which performs at the Triple Crown Theater at 330 7th Avenue in New York, New York, every Sunday night. And in this episode, she talked about her life as a musician and as a music teacher and the current children's music she's been writing, like that clip I just played earlier, was from her song, Keep Your Fingers Out of Your Nose. Anyway, here's the conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. All right, we can begin.
We can begin.
Yes, with DZ Zimmer. B.S., did you want to introduce yourself? How would you introduce yourself?
What do you mean, how I would describe myself?
Yeah.
I kind of think that that's pretty much what the whole interview is going to answer. I could say how I met you.
Yeah.
That would be a good start. Okay, so I'm DZ, and I met Sean at an improv class. And then we became part of an improv team that performs on Sunday nights. And improv is, I guess, my most recent creative endeavor. And now I've been taking more classes, and it's what is bringing the most excitement to my life right now. And I really love it, and I find it rejuvenating and re-exciting pretty much everything in my life.
It was music for a while, right?
Oh, it still is music. I mean, yeah. I guess if I had to pick a way to define myself, I would still define myself as a musician. It's funny when people ask me how long I've been doing improv, and the fact is that that's only really been a few months, but yet I feel in another way that I've been doing it all my life, because as a musician, as an entertainer, and I'll get back to that in a minute, and then as a teacher and a teacher of musical theater to children, it's all like of one thing. When I referred to being an entertainer, for a lot of years I was playing in piano bars and also, you know, hotel lounges. And I was a lot of times played with bands, but most of the time by myself singing and playing the piano. And of course, in between songs, I would talk to the audience. Sometimes, depending, you know, the place, sometimes less, sometimes more. A lot of bad jokes. I always liked bad jokes. The cornier, the better. which serves me very well now working with children. But and also really liked really corny jokes when I was in non-English speaking countries, because I could say anything. But that's all improv, you know, and it's the same thing, because people will comment, you know, that I seem very at ease on stage, and it's because I've always been on stage in one form or another doing something. And it's the same with teaching. I mean, teaching is performing, you know. And it was actually, I got into improv officially to try to also help with my teaching. Interestingly, it went in a very different direction. You don't mind if I just keep talking,
no,
or should I wait for a question?
Okay.
It's supposed to be an interview, not a monologue. But see, this is why improv is also good for me, because I have to stop and listen to my partner every now and then, because otherwise I'll just keep going forever. One of the hardest things in teaching is what they call classroom management, which, you know, if I had my druthers, I'd just, oh, can we use language?
Yeah, language is fine, yeah.
If I had my druthers, I'd put the little fuckers in their seats, tell them to shut up and listen to all the pearls of wisdom coming out of me and just be grateful for it. But we can't do that. So we have to manage them, air quotes, you know, we have to, because young children don't want to sit in their seats and listen to you, no matter how great what you have to offer is. So I felt somehow that I needed to create more authority. So this summer, among other things, I took some private acting classes, and my preconception was that I was going to develop a persona that had greater authority, so that when I would walk into the classroom or the kids would walk into my classroom, I would speak and they would immediately tremble and obey. I would really like the trembling and obeying, you know, just once a little trembling and obeying, but no. What was really interesting was that the teacher very, very instinctively and astutely kind of saw things about me that she could kind of understand where there was, because there was a breakdown somewhere in communication. If, I mean, there's always going to be times that kids are not doing what you want them to, but if it's happening, you know, 80% of the time, you know, the goal, and she talked about this a lot, like in acting you have an objective and in life you have an objective, and so we approached like life and acting in a lot of the same ways. And so if you're not getting your objective, then you need to change something you're doing. And it's kind of common sense, except a lot of people never do that.
Yeah.
They keep thinking, if I just do the same thing again and again, somehow something's going to change. It's the definition of insanity. So, you know, if I say sit down and you don't, if I say it louder and you still don't, and I say it really loud and you don't, and I say it really, really loud and I stamp my foot and I get red in the face, you're not going to. And this is so... I have to do something different. And so her response was that instead of my trying to get more authoritative, that I break down this wall of my trying to like tell them what to do, and I, you know, get more, I try to relate to them more, and I try to kind of get them to tell me what they want to do and then kind of negotiate. So a great example is like this year, I have a class of fourth graders and we're learning the melodica, which I don't know if you're familiar with it. It has a little keyboard, but you blow into it. So it kind of looks like a small synthesizer, but it gets its sound by being blown into. And So they're fourth graders, and there's 32 of them, so it's a big class. And I see them three times a week. So I knew very quickly I had to get a good rapport with them, because otherwise there's a lot of them, and I see them three times a week, nobody's going to be happy. So the first thing was I devised a really, because they're a little bit older, a more detailed, the younger ones, they have a good day, I give them a piece of candy, you know, it's easy. But they're older, so I got a really complex reward system where I have what's called, so the program that is called Let Me Catch You Being Awesome. So I have to catch them doing something. But being awesome can be as simple as following directions, you know. Then I have the awesome emoji chart, and it goes up on the smart board, and they have their names, and the awesome emoji is just the cool guy with the sunglasses. And in a week, they need to get 10. So every time I catch them being awesome, they get an awesome emoji. And if they get 10 at the end of the week, then on the following Monday, I have a treasure chest, and I took suggestions of what they wanted to see in their treasure chest, and I said, you know, if you ask for a cell phone or a computer, you're not going to get it. Or one kid actually did ask for a Lamborghini. I was like, you're not getting it. But, you know, I said, but within reason. And they came up with great suggestions, slime, Roblox toys, Fortnite model figurines, keychains with emojis, and, you know, so I made this really nice, you know, treasure chest. And once a week now, you know, so it's this ongoing process. Every class they see how they're adding the emojis, and then they get a present. So it's really, they're engaged in it full time. It's almost like learning to play the melodica is like a side issue. They're really there to get emojis and get a present. But, you know, so they're willing to go along and learn the melodica so that they can. So I've changed the whole focus. It's now about what they're going to get, you know? And so that's what I mean by, you know, kind of, I'm not asking them why they act out. You know, they act out because they're 9 years old. They're, you know, that's what they do. But now they're actively engaged in getting themselves presents, you know. So, and it's a really nice thing. One kid earlier in the year was very much like, just being really bizarre, shrieking and getting out of his seat. And I remembered him from last year that he really liked to be in front of the room. So when they're playing, I have like the notes of what they're playing. So, and I was standing and pointing. I gave him the baton and let him stand and point to the notes. So this way I was also free, and this was one of the things the acting teacher talked to me about moving the focus around in the room, that I shouldn't always be in the front of the room. So I put a kid in the front, let him point to the notes. I walk around the room. So now also it closes the barrier between me and the kids, because now I can hands-on help them, because some of them need me to put their hands on the instrument. I can walk around and check in with them, so that causes them to act out less, because they never know where I'm going to pop up. And also I'm now on a more intimate level with them. And now this kid is at the front of the room where he wants to be with a baton, and he took to it like a natural, and he's waving that baton around, and he's pointing to the right notes and doing the right thing. And everybody was happy. And after a couple of classes of doing that, he was happy to go back to his seat and play the instrument. And now he only every now and then needs to go up and do that. And it was like he stopped being a problem, you know? Yeah. And these are creative. These are not things I would have done before improv and before having this acting lesson, because it just, you know, I was, this is what I mean by the spontaneity and the flexibility of like just doing.
And you put
doing
on a show with the kids, right?
Yeah.
Vaudeville.
Right. That's this. My second grade is doing the vaudeville show, which is right before Thanksgiving. I do shows, themed shows with all the younger groups, the younger grades, like so from pre-K through second grade. And then the older grades, we do like variety shows where they play instruments. I teach currently, in addition to the melodica, keyboards, ukulele, guitar, and rock band and chorus. And so with the older, like from third up, we do like a talent show or a variety show where we'll have a guitar group and a ukulele group and a vocal group and like that. And the younger ones will do one of my favorite shows that I did with pre-K, actually. It's called Too Much Noise. And it's actually based on a Russian fable, a Russian / Yiddish fable about, the original was there's too much, my house is too crowded. And the guy goes to the village elder, my house is too crowded. And he says, bring in your in-laws. And then he says, bring in the sheep and the cow. And and then he goes back, he says, now it's still too crowded. And then he says, get rid of all the animals. And he says, oh, now my house is peaceful, when it's the same that it started out, just by contrast. But in our version, it's too much noise. And it's the same thing, except it's noise-based because it's a musical. And it's really cute because now these kids are 4 years old. So it has to be really simple. So it starts off, you know, the floor creaked, and they all go, creak, the chairs squeak, squeak, the water drip, drip, drop, drip, drop, drip, drop, the clock tick, tick, tock, tick, tock, tick, tock, the wind blew, ooh, Jacob and his family were miserable, too much noise. And they chant this like about at least 10 times throughout the show. And then, so he goes to the wise person, and he says, get a horse. And then, so, and the horse neighed, neigh! And then they go through the whole litany, and so by animal, by animal. And I always get cute props, so I got all the stuffed animals of each animal that comes in. The kid hauls it, the horse neighed, neigh! And so that's what I do with the four-year-olds, and it's very cute. And the ones who were portraying, like, the door and the floor and the chair, we got them big things that they wore around their necks, and, you know, very, very cute, you know. And then as they go up a grade, the shows, you know, get a little bit more. You know, there's always some kind of a educational aspect, like even with the vaudeville, it's like the history of vaudeville. And we have like
is that like something that inspired you, like vaudeville, like early?
Well, not really. You mean in general? No.
Yeah, or like stuff from that era?
Not really. I mean, I respect pretty much all forms of entertainment, but that's not a particular thing. It was just something for this particular show, but not, that's not. You know, I mean, my earliest influences, well, I started playing classical piano when I was, like, in the womb, almost literally. when I was three, you know. I mean, I just took to it pretty naturally. And my father started teaching me, and then I got a teacher, and I, you know, had a very traditional classical early training. And then when I was in high school, I started playing guitar, and I just, you know, I still loved classical, and I still do, but I really, at that time, I didn't only want to play other people's music, I really wanted to play my own, and that was when I started writing. And when I was still in high school, I started playing in all kinds of clubs in the village. And I was really pushing to be a singer-songwriter in those days when there were singer-songwriters.
So it was like folk kind of stuff?
No, but I was never a folky. It was kind of the folk culture. It might not be the exact word, but that's where that was happening, but it wasn't only folk. I mean, even at that time, I mean, there were a lot of folk people, but there were a lot that weren't. You know, my style was never folk. I was always, I guess, more pop. I guess more of like the Carole King kind of, you know, even though I resisted being compared to her. But it was kind of where everybody, that was where everybody's thought process went, because I was a girl and I played the piano, so, you know, Carole King, you know. But in retrospect, and when I look at, you know, what I was doing, yeah, it's a fair assessment. And definitely, so that was pretty much, you know, and then I got more new wavy, and I was very into Patti Smith for a while. I was really, 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 really into Patti Smith. And then I was
into... So like early punk?
Yeah, sort of like, yeah. And very into Cyndi Lauper also. Somewhat into Madonna, but I liked Cyndi Lauper better. And did a couple of rounds of really trying to break through, you know, made a couple of demos.
You had like a band together, or you mostly just did?
At that time, I had live musicians. That was still when you used live musicians. I had a couple of bands that, you know, I played out with a lot, and you know, I was in some cover bands, and then I was working with some musicians working on my own music, and we did a couple of demos, and I really, you know, sent them out, but I just never really could get off the ground with it. You know, I had one manager for like 5 minutes who, you know, talked a big talk and never really did anything, and played a few clubs, and you know, that was what I really had wanted, but it just, you know, didn't happen. And then I kind of made a decision, and at that time, so I was living in New York, I was working at other things, and trying to, at one point I was like working in a law firm, playing in a cover band on the weekends, and trying to do my music with my band and make a demo. And you know, that runs you ragged. And so I made a decision that it was more important to me to play music and to play music full time. And that if I wasn't gonna be a star, that was okay. But I couldn't do this work in a law firm and try and hope for the impossible dream.
And then that's when you got into like the cruise ships.
Well, yeah. Everybody fixates on the cruise ships, which was only a small part, but that's when I got into the traveling. Because the thing also with New York that I found was that if I wanted to work steadily full time as a musician, it's really hard to do that in New York.
Because there's so much competition, yeah.
But the minute, and also like New York, at least I haven't looked into it more recently, but at least at the time, you know, it's a one night here, one night there, one night here, one night there. And it's really hard. It's nerve-wracking, and it's not any kind of consistency, you know, unless you're Bobby Short. And even he was only at the Carlisle, I think, a couple of nights a week. He wasn't there 6 nights a week, you know. He didn't have to be, but, you know. So it was actually a pretty interesting moment, because it's one of those, every now and then you have a moment. I was working in a law firm, I remember, and it was January, the first week in January. It was very, very cold. And I had answered an ad in the Village Voice, which used to be my go-to source for everything. And it was for an all-girl band that needed a singing keyboard player, you know. And I left work early. I went home. I got my keyboard. They were out in Connecticut. I got on the train. I went to Connecticut. I auditioned for them. This was a Wednesday. They said, "You're hired." I went to work the next day, Thursday. I said, "Guess what, guys? Tomorrow's my last day." Saturday morning, 5 girls, 3 guitars, a drum set, and a keyboard, and a bunch of amps are in a van driving from Waterbury, Connecticut to Fort Myers, Florida. In the van with headphones, I had to learn 30 songs over that weekend. Which, so me and the headphones in the van driving, like, not quite nonstop, but, you know, driving, We stop at like a tiny motel, like, you know, and since we weren't working at that moment, five girls in a hotel room, two beds in a cot, you get two double beds in a cot and like put the cot in the middle. So we're like five in a row in the bed and, you know, sharing a six pack of beer and splitting the last beer because we're five of us and six beers. And get to Fort Myers on Monday and set up and, you know, play the gig. And that was the beginning of 15 years on the road. And so I traveled with them for about a year and a half around the country. And then I switched to, and that was Top 40, and I switched to another Top 40 band that wasn't all girls. The all-girl band, by the way, was called Sugar. And we had this sign that said Sugar, and it was pink with white sparkles.
And what was, like, the way to, so was there, like, how did you find out about, like, auditions back then?
Because I know that was the Village Voice. The Village Voice. Everything.
So that was kind of like.
That was the go to. Well, that was the backstage of music, for music.
Yeah.
I mean, backstage didn't. That was, you know, for theater stuff. But Village Voice had the music ads. That was everything. All the musicians I worked with, all the gigs I got, everything was from the Village Voice. That was the Bible, you know. And so then I got with another band, another Top 40 band for like another year and a half. And then after that, I came home very briefly and I was looking for another setup like that. And while I was, I found my first piano bar at a resort setup. And I was still really in the mood to be with another Top 40 band. But this thing was a much sweeter setup, more money, but it was, you know, being by myself. But I always enjoyed my own company. And this was a really luxurious resort in the Dominican Republic, a very famous resort, Casa de Campo. And it was really luxurious. So even when I was on the road with bands, I mean, it was, you know, everything you envision about being on the road with a band. It was kind of rough and tumble, but I loved it. But now it was the other end of the spectrum. I mean, I was living full time at this 5-star resort, and I was playing like 3.5 hours in the evening at this, you know, the resort had like five-star restaurants. I was playing in their French restaurant. You know, they had like five different cuisines in the, you know, and so I was playing in the French restaurant, and it was elegant and standards and jazz and like that. So of course I had to go from the Top 40 repertoire to the jazz and standard repertoire, but I pretty much had that, and because I had studied jazz and I had that, so I brushed off that repertoire, put the Top 40, you know, to rest. The good thing about doing jazz and standards is you don't have to worry about being current. We're Top 40, you have to kind of try to stay current. And that was just, that was, you know, that was the life. That was just 6 months of having to make really huge decisions every day. Should I go to the beach? Should I go to the pool? Should I go horseback riding in the morning or in the afternoon? Should I have shrimp or lobster? Should I have a margarita? Should I have a pina colada? You know, it's a tough life. And I played for 3.5 hours in the evening, you know, and everybody was so genteel and, you know. And so after that, I never really went back to the Top 40 thing, you know. Yeah. I stayed.
Were there things like you missed about being on the road? Was there some ways?
No, not really. You know, I adapted to luxury very quickly.
Okay.
I did miss playing with bands, but I had other, like sometimes, and you mentioned cruise ships, and so this next period of like the next 12 years of resorts and cruise ships and just plain old luxury hotels, a lot of the time was alone, but some of the times, like especially on the ships, they would have a house band, And a lot of times we would mix and match where I would do sets with the bands, or like the trumpet player would sit in and do a set with me. So, and even in some of the hotels, there was a lot of that, you know, where there was cross matching. Cross-fertilization, you know, where people, and there was sometimes hotels where they would have, you know, another lounge with another piano player, and we would, you know, do that, or, you know, other, like a combo. So there was a lot of, you know, opportunities, you know, not all the time, but certainly some, because I do enjoy playing with other musicians, you know. And it's nice to have that, you know, so you're not constantly
working with, like, adding.
Yeah.
I guess, like, the same way as you enjoy, like, improv.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. It gives that other dynamic that you're not navel gazing all the time. You're not eating your own tail. It's funny. Somebody said something in a class, in an improv class the other day about, we give each other suggestions, why don't we give ourselves a suggestion? Because the fact that you're responding to a suggestion and you're responding in your own way, you know, and a lot of times you respond in a way that's unexpected or maybe unintended, so you are in a way doing your own suggestion, but it's coming off of something. And I remember at the time, I didn't answer out loud, but at the time thinking, giving yourself a suggestion is almost, the vision I got was like eating your own tail, or to be more crass,
it defeats the whole point, because like the suggestion is so you do something you wouldn't think of otherwise.
Right, or to be more crass about it, more like masturbating, you know, you're not getting that outer stimulus, you know. So I like that it, you know, even if you respond in as indirectly a way as possible, or like at the magnet mixers, they do it musically, and they, you know, they don't say it, they just play a piece of music and it's however you, but it's still somehow coming from, you know, that little bit of uncertainty that kind of adds the spice. And that's the same thing when you're working, whether with another improviser or with a another musician. Even like I told you about that scene at the mixer that I did, that was an 8-person scene, and all I did was one shriek, because we were trapped in the Hall of Mirrors, and one person suggested that the route out might be sonar related, and I shrieked, and then they said that that revealed the way out, and it was, that was my entire contribution, was a shriek, and it felt so gratifying because it fit, all the pieces fit together.
Because it was like the main thing, well, right? It got everybody out of there.
Yeah, but it was just that, so sometimes that one thing, that one element is what puts it all together.
Yeah.
Which relates right back to one of my favorite classes that I teach for middle schoolers, 7th and 8th grade, is rock band. And I started doing this a few years ago, and what I love about it so much is that I formed this rock band and nobody actually learns how to play an instrument, or just a little bit. Because what I do is, so a basic drum kit, well, you know, you're a drummer.
A bassist.
Yeah,
drum is like the one instrument I could never figure out.
Oh, okay.
So it's funny.
All right. Well, then you'll probably enjoy this anyway. Yeah. A drum kit, your basic drum kit has a few elements. It has a kick drum, has a hi-hat, which is those two cymbals that open and close, has a crash cymbal, it has a few toms, a floor tom and a big tom and a little tom, and it has a snare, which has that rattly sound. And a drummer learns to play them all at the same time, which is a lot of fun. I started learning drums couple of years ago, and I love playing drums. That was my last big excitement, which still absolutely excites me, but before improv, that was kind of all I talked about was drums, and I still, once I start, I really love playing drums. So what I do, and the way this all started, actually, and I haven't thought about that in a while, a few years ago I had this 5th and 6th grade special ed class, and it was 8 boys. And the first day they came into my class, so they're special ed, they were like, you know, emotionally challenged. And fifth and sixth grade, which is kind of a tough year, and they came in, and they're big boys, and they came into my room, and we hate music, we don't want to do music, we hate. So I was like, okay, well, is there any kind of music that you don't, anything you could imagine that you don't hate? And one of them said, yeah, drums. And at that time, all I had in my room was just drums for like little kids, like little baby bongos, and not anything I would even like go, these kids would be insulted. But they used to have a marching band, not really like a drum line in my school, but the guy that did it had left. So I took my eight boys and we went on a field trip through the school to what I knew was like this hidden secret storeroom, and we found all these abandoned pieces of the drums from the drum line. And I had those boys, since they were big boys, carry them to my room, but it was all bits and pieces. So I put one kid on the kick, and one kid on the snare, and one kid on the hi-hat, and one kid on the tom, and one kid on the, like that, because they were all broken up. And I knew enough at that point, that was before I took drum lessons, to know, okay, the kick plays on 1 and 3, and the snare goes on 2 and 4. And that took like about 4 weeks to learn that.
And they had issues with like anger, or and I guess
everything, that, yeah. Just emotion. Yeah, but so yeah, hitting stuff was great.
Yeah.
You know? And so by like a few months, they were keeping time, and I would play the keyboards and sing, and we would do like classic rock, and like We Will Rock You was always, every class I do on whatever instrument I teach, we always do We Will Rock You in some form or another. Everybody loves that. And we put together, by the end of the year, we had like 10 songs we could play. So that was my first foray. And then the next year, I added bass guitar and electric guitar and tambourines and xylophones, and my principal loved it, and she bought me all these instruments, you know. And so now that's what we do. But each kid plays one thing. Even on like the bass, they play one. So I have two basses, so one kid plays one, the other kid plays the other note, like they'll be thum, 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 and they quit. And the same thing with the guitar, like one will do one strum, one will do the other. On the keyboards, they do one note, on the xylophone, and each drum. And we sound, if you didn't know what was it, we sound authentic. And I love it. And everybody feels like, yeah, we're playing rock and roll. You would not know. People walk by all the time, they're like, wow, how are you doing that? And like everybody's just doing one little thing. So that comes back to the one shriek of like working together. And it's very, very exciting, because it really is like a tapestry of how everybody contributes just the right thing.
Yeah.
And it's amazing.
Yeah. Well, like I was just thinking, like the VR set and the Mac, like I ended the scene. I didn't do anything.
Yeah, and that was like the most amazing thing. Yeah. Because
they were building it up all along, like
yeah.
Using Netflix. Because the scene was that the guy was paying more attention to Netflix than his girlfriend.
And then
Netflix kept bringing in different stuff, and I ended it with here's the Netflix VR set. Now you can live in Netflix.
That was awesome. And that was, sometimes it's just that one thing, you know. So that was the... So that's a lot of nice. So I enjoy it's teamwork, you know. It's the cliche about teamwork makes the dream work, but it is really true. And you know, everything, seeing how the music and the improv and, you know, the individual acting and all of it just kind of, you know, fits together and can be, you know, life enhancing, which I think that there's so much that potentially is stressful and sad in the world, that I think anywhere that we can find joy and bring joy, you know, it's almost like I feel like it's an obligation, you know, because the sadness and the stress is going to find us all by itself. So, you know, and I feel like for a while I was really feeling a lot of stress about teaching, and improv has definitely lightened.
Just by bringing more fun into the
course. Yeah. Well, because it's bringing more fun to me and just making me more open. And,
and you started writing, now children's music, like you started writing children's music.
Yeah, because, you know, I still love doing my original music. You know, I love writing and I love singing my own music. And because I wanted to do it, actually the first song that I wrote and performed at school that was kind of geared towards kids was after Hurricane Sandy. And it was about how, you know, no matter how much the water can come and the wind can blow, it's not going to blow us down, it's not going to knock us down, you know, we're still going to stand together and stand strong, and you know, like that. And we actually did it, this goes back to that year, at the school talent show. We had the guitar group, the ukulele group, we had a violin group at the time, and like the middle school and the elementary school chorus, like we had practically the whole school sang that song, you know, and it was really, really a nice thing that we did. And that was when I just got more geared towards doing that, and then wrote more songs really geared specifically towards kids. And I have a partner at school who also teaches music, and we do a lot of the shows together, and we also do a sing-along program with the four-year-olds, and we do existing children's songs with them, with a lot of finger plays and movement and like that. And I really love performing with her, and we do really nice harmonies, so we even take like regular old children's songs and we put really nice harmonies to them and make them just musically more interesting. And then we've worked out a lot of our own like little shtick with certain songs that we do, where we do kind of little comedic bits of business. So again, the improv and the comedy and playing off of each other. We do this silly thing called Down by the Bay, and it's down by the bay, you know, you see all these animals and they're silly little rhymes, but we do this thing where we interrupt each other all the time and like, well, I saw this animal and it was doing this. Really? Did you see that? And you know, and where was that? Only one place? Where could that possibly be? And then we go back into the song and it started out as like a short little thing. Now we can do that one song for like 15 minutes if we had, you know, to build on it. And so that's, you know, doing that. And anyway, so my partner, so again, these kids are 4 years old and they're sitting in front of us, and little kids with little fingers like to put their little fingers in their little noses. And so several times my partner would like stop us. I always am reminded of Jimmy Durante talking about vaudeville, you know, stop the music. But every now and then she would like, stop, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. She always says, but these children, you've got to stop putting your fingers in your noses, that spreads germs. So one day after this little tirade of hers, I was like inspired and came up with the song which you're familiar with, which I know you said you wanted to play an excerpt of.
Yeah, you said. Yeah, right. That you sent to me, the one that
yes. Keep right, and so I came up with Keep Your Fingers Out of Your Nose. And so I wrote the song, so the next day I saw her and I said, well, this song is for you, and I played it. And that has become now a staple of our repertoire, and you know, whenever she sees it happening now, she says to me, I think it's time for one of life's lessons. And I said, yes, listen, children, it's time for a life's lesson. And we do the song, and you know, we wave our fingers, because if our fingers in the air, it's not in our noses.
So are you looking to like record more children's songs and like put out a children's music album?
Well, what I've done and what I'm working on is, see, there's a lot of books, children's books that have songs with them. And that's what I'm looking to actually package. And I actually have a gal who's a tattoo artist, and she's working on illustrating the songs, which are going to be kind of the lyrics as is, but with each page illustrated. And I'm looking to package that so as a book with a CD, and each song would be its own book. And so I'm probably looking to maybe publish the first one next summer, which would be Fingers, as I affectionately call it, you know, where the kids are exploring, you know, the good things that you do with your fingers. And then I have like a bunch of caricatures of what it looks like if your fingers in your nose and it gets bigger and bigger, and you know. Yeah. So the pictures kind of amplify the story, you know, that is already being told in the songs. And so I have four that I've recorded that I'm looking to illustrate, and I have a fifth one now that I'm probably going to be recording probably over the Christmas break.
So you would like to get that out there more, like,
yeah, that's the long-term project now, you know, as opposed to being the next Cyndi Lauper. You know, the long-term project now is to get each of these books out. And, you know, because the schools use them. I use them in my curriculum all the time. There's a whole bunch of these books that, you know, these beautifully illustrated books with music. And it's because kids now need multisensory. It's not, they're not going to just listen to you read a book anymore. They need the pictures, and then they actually animate the illustrations as videos.
They make it fun.
Like, yeah. So it's a song, it's a video, it's pictures, it's a whole, you know, virtual reality eventually. And so, yeah, so that's where I'm aiming. You know, if I can have my books in the school, and the books written by me will be part of the curriculum I'm teaching, and so then when I retire, that'll still be a source of income. That would be really, you know, that would be an acceptable way to go out, you know. So I would have, again, not having been a rock star, but at least had made some kind of a mark, you know, of having made recordings that, you know, were beyond just, you know, in my living room and in emailed to my friends, you know.
Yeah.
You know, even if it wasn't mainstream, even if it was just as part of a school curriculum, you know, that would still be something that, you know, I would feel it was some little piece of what, you know, my original ambition was.
But you've written like music all throughout each period of your life, while you were doing like
performing at the resort. Always. I mean, every now and then something would just strike me, and you know, whether it was scribbled on a napkin or something, and you know.
And would you find like time to perform it in between, like?
Well, I always managed to slip it into my performance. Like, you know, if I was with a rock band, I would have a rock tune. I've written some very things that slip right into the jazz and standard that you almost, you know, I've had people come up to me and say, that was some obscure, who wrote that? That's one I've never heard before. And I was like, well, that was an original. And they were like, but that sounded like it was written in the 40s. And I was like, well, yeah, you know. But as a classical musician, I can write, and I learned how to write in the style of Mozart and Chopin. And if I can write in the style of Mozart and Chopin, I can also write in the style of Gershwin.
You see, like, what chords, you know, what patterns
yeah.
there is in each genre.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can write in the style of Gershwin, and I can, you know, and one of the things I used to do as a kid was improvise chopsticks in every style, from like ragtime to Chopin to, you know, blues to whatever, you know. So, you know, that's, which again, improv, you know, but, so I've always managed to, wherever I was performing in whatever venue and whatever style, I've always managed to slip in an original here and there, you know, and
improv is like the main performing you're doing now. It's just, so you're teaching and doing the class, but the only performance now you're doing is, improv, or are you doing some music?
Well, I'm not performing music out like in a club, but I'm always playing. I'm playing all day, every day. I mean, you know, I'm singing We Will Rock You 5 times a week, you know. No, you know, I mean, when I play with my rock band students, you know, especially as they get more proficient, you know, for me there's like no difference than, you know, I mean, it's the same, you know, because for me to give that performance the same as if I was on a stage somewhere elevates them and honors what they're doing, you know. And I very often, and this is when it's at its best, when they're not resisting, at its best, you know, there'll be that connection. Like, it's silly, but like when we do We Will Rock You, so on the in-between We Will Rock You, so I have the person on the tom, you know, go boom, boom, and then the person on the crash go shh, so it's boom, boom, shh. And at first, even that's a little bit challenging, but when they get that, and this is such a little thing, but when they get that and they get the timing right, and I make that eye contact, which is exactly the same as what I would do with any band member, and there's that click of that timing, I mean, that's awesome. Whether that person is, you know, a top rocker or a fifth grader or an eighth grader, you know, when, and it's the same thing with improv, you know, when you have a creative click, it's awesome no matter who it is, where it is, what it is. You know, when there's that moment of understanding, you know, of that goes beyond understanding, that moment of creativity,
yeah,
that is beyond any, you know, words or any
explanation. It's just like it's there, kind
of, yeah. 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 Like that shriek and that
it just
created
kind of
the way out.
You don't even
yeah
know where it came
yeah
from, I guess. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, you know, to me, that is kind of the most profound, most, if you want to say spiritual or most elevated thing, you know, and it could be any art form, when you're creating something that didn't exist before, that didn't come from logic or rationality, you know, that you can't explain, but that is more than was there before. That, I mean, that's creation. Something that wasn't yes there a minute ago and now it's there.
Yeah, it's like, where does it come from? I don't know. It's like, yeah.
I mean, that to me, that's the most joyous
yeah
and elevated thing that can happen. And
yeah
it could happen.
And then when you're
anything
working with other people, it's like you pick up on exactly the other person's thing. It's like this, I don't know. Mm.
I think we're yeah kind of winding down. Just one other little story that is also joyous, and it happened in a very small town in Japan over the holidays a long, long time ago, about connecting with other people. So I was at this hotel, I think it was a small town in Japan, and I was playing in, you know, in the restaurant in the piano lounge, and the hotel manager came to me and said that they were in a few weeks having a staff Christmas party, and that there were several members of the staff who played instruments, and would I organize like a staff band for the party? And so, sure. And like the butcher played the drums, and the pastry chef played the bass guitar, and I don't know, the head of housekeeping played the saxophone, and you know, and they're all Japanese, and they spoke, you know, a little bit of English here and there. And I have to tell you, that was one of the most hysterical and warmest and wonderfulest things I had ever experienced, because it was just so wacky. And you know, we'd have rehearsal, like when they were done working, you know, the butcher would have his bloody apron and, you know, and the chef with the pastry chef would still have his hat on, and he'd take his hat, and it was so great. And you know, I mean, they were okay, they were, but we had so much fun, and we did like, you know, 50s and 60s, you know, just like rock, like Beatles and Johnny B. Goode and Twist and Shout and all that, you know, and it was for the, and what a blast we had. And then they would take me to dinner in like these tiny hole in the wall, the real authentic, not the touristy restaurants, but the real authentic, and what, and then we would go out drinking and some of the Japanese can really drink, you know, they would drink sake and, you know, So those were just like great, you know, every now and then, you know, those things that would happen in my travels, like just great little things of, you know, connections and things that you would never expect to happen in a million years of like, you know, me and, you know, the staff of this hotel formed a band and, you know, played for Christmas. It was, so that was...
Like the adventure.
Yeah. A great adventure.
So any final thoughts?
Well, that, I thought that was a good note to end on. And the adventure continues. And, you know, improv is absolutely a fantastic, exciting adventure. And it's an inner and an outer adventure. And I think those are the best kind.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on. And you can see me and DZ perform Sundays at the Triple Crown with the folks about the town. Or the fat. Or whatever you want.
Oh, I said F-A-double-T.
F-A-double-T.
Because we're not fat. Yeah. Well, thank you, Sean, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for, this was good.
All right, so that was the conversation. I hope you enjoyed it. You can see DZ and I perform with our improv team, Folks About the Town, every Sunday night, like I just said at the end of that interview, but I guess I'm double saying it. And it was very interesting hearing her story, and I didn't know, like, I've been doing improv with her for a while, so I didn't know, like, all that about, you know, when she traveled with the Top 40 band or when she played at that resort for many years. So that was definitely interesting learning more about her through that that interview. And also what she said about how she wanted to always work in the music industry, even if, you know, she wasn't a star. I think there's a, you know, there's many ways to work in the entertainment industry. And if that's really what you love, you know, it's good to look into what different roles you can play in it. Anyway, you can keep updated with future episodes of BSing with Sean K on Spotify and iTunes and everything else. And the next episode will be my 100th episode, and I will be doing something special for that. And then I might be taking a break. There might be a little break before I release my 100th episode, too. So, yeah, I'll catch you on the next one. BSing with, BSing with.